Hello and welcome to the Pax Mundi show. I'm your host Nigel, and tonight I'm going to be trying to shed some light on the new dark age of the global war on terror, and to deconstruct some of the lies and mystifications about the global war on terror. So firstly, I'm going to take some news from the various front lines of that global war of terror. In Gaza, the Israeli Air Force killed one Palestinian man and wounded another one in the Gaza Strip. The victim in his 20s was identified as Haltam al-Meshal. The Israeli military said he was a militant involved in a rocket attack on Israel. But a spokesperson for the Gazan Health Ministry said he was a Palestinian police officer. Over in Damascus, an explosion rocked the capital city there. Government buildings were blown up. Over 13 killed and lots more wounded. It would appear to have been an attack on the Prime Minister, who was the target of that attack. Staying with Syria, the UN is seeking more concrete evidence to establish whether Bashar al-Assad's government has used chemical weapons in its conflict with the rebels. While the US and other countries say that they believe the regime is using the nerve agent sarin. Indeed, Israel and the UK claim that they have evidence of this. So Ban Ki-moon has said that the UN won't make any decision at the moment. Let's wait and see, but clearly the issue of the chemical weapons is being used as a pretense to go to war and to escalate the conflict there by intervention from the Western powers. Over in Iraq, the death toll from car bombings in the Shiite areas south of Baghdad has reached at least 36 this week. This is in the lead up to the elections. Over 200 people have died in attacks and clashes in the past week since security forces raided a Sunni protest camp. In Mexico, peace activists have been demonstrating against the United States, demanding that they stop the flow of assault weapons that are fueling Mexico's bloody drug war. More than 68% of the weapons recovered by authorities in Mexico have been traced back to the US. Over in Europe, the European Commission has voted to impose a continent-wide ban on the neonicotinoid pesticides, which were are believed to be seriously harmful to bees. Clearly, there has been a serious decline in the bee population, both in Europe and worldwide. In fact, does appear to be the use of pesticides that are lowering the bees' immunity, natural immunity to disease and parasites. Unfortunately, the UK actually opposed this measure, and indeed the UK is saying that they may actually opt out of this measure. So you know, they can't really sink much lower there, can they? You know, even our government doesn't even care about the bees. News from Guantanamo, which I'm going to be talking about later, the US military have admitted that there are now 100 prisoners on hunger strike at Guantanamo. Those of you who've listened to earlier shows may recall that this is, you know, what we've been saying all along for months, that there are over 100 prisoners on hunger strike. So they've now admitted that this week. At first they had denied that there was hunger strikes, and then they said it was only a few hunger strikes. And, you know, now they're actually, you know, admitting that the majority of the prisoners are on hunger strike. David Remes, a lawyer for the prisoners, said the military at first denied there was a hunger strike. The only hunger strike it acknowledged was the hunger strikers, where the hunger strikers have been striking before February. But detainees have told us that nearly 130 of them were on hunger strike. And it's interesting, because gradually, week by week and day by day, the Guantanamo authorities have been acknowledging higher and higher numbers, to the point where they're now acknowledging that 100 men are on hunger strike. We said about 130, and at least 20 are being force-fed daily. Pakistan has been hit by a wave of violence ahead of the coming elections. There have been a series of deadly attacks ahead of the general elections set for next month. This is just 2 days ago. There were a series of bombings which wounded more than killed 7 people and wounded more than 24 on the road in Peshawar. The Taliban has claimed responsibility for all of these bombings at the campaign offices of independent candidates. That killed at least 9 people on Saturday. Human Rights Watch reports at least 70 people have died in election-related attacks by the Taliban and others since April. In the city of Karachi, residents said the violence would possibly prevent people from going to vote. Two residents quoted Mohammed Entisham: if this situation of blast continues, then it will be difficult for people to come out and cast their vote. Everyone will look for their safety first. Nasir Sumro: these bomb blasts and firing incidents are scaring people. Every normal person will get frightened. Fear is a normal thing. Why should someone take a risk, and what for? Voting is not so important to people that they would sacrifice their lives and get killed for it. Staying back in Iraq, the Iraqi government has suspended the licenses of over 10 satellite TV channels, including Al Jazeera, accusing them of fueling sectarian violence. Iraq's media commission said the stations broadcast clear calls for disorder and endorsed banned terrorist organizations. In a statement, Al Jazeera said it was astonished by the move. We cover all sides of the story, they said, in Iraq, and have done for many years. The fact that so many channels have been hit all at once, though, suggests that this is an indiscriminate decision. The move follows the wave of violence. In Afghanistan, there's been revelations from the New York Times about the CIA corruption in Afghanistan. The Times has reported on their investigations that, you know, they have proof of the payments made to the Afghan government, large amounts of cash being taken on a weekly basis to the government offices by the CIA. And these are, hundreds of millions of dollars that are being used to fuel corruption and to empower the paramilitary warlords. A former Karzai aide told the New York Times that Afghan officials referred to the cash as ghost money because it came in secret and it left in secret, they said. The Times concluded that much of the CIA's money goes to paying off warlords and politicians, many of whom have ties to the drug trade and, in some cases, the Taliban. The result, American and Afghan officials said, is that the agency has greased the wheels of the same patronage networks that American diplomats and law enforcement agents have struggled unsuccessfully to dismantle, leaving the government in the grips of what are basically organized crime syndicates. The report comes as the US is intending to turn over more power to Afghan authorities ahead of a planned troop withdrawal next year. In Afghanistan, there were four US service members killed in a plane crash that is stated to be an accident. In the US, in New York, 31 people were arrested on Sunday at the Hancock Air Force Base as they protested the killing of innocent civilians by drone strikes that they say are violating the US Constitution. The Hancock Air Force Base is a departure point for drones, and roughly 300 people held a funeral procession to condemn the use of drones in Yemen, Somalia, Pakistan and Afghanistan. The protesters were members of the Coalition to Ground the Drones and End the Wars. They attempted to deliver an indictment charging President Obama, the military and service members at Hancock Air Base with crimes against humanity. The UN Security Council has just voted to send UN troops to Mali. This seems to be standard, that where there is Western intervention in internal conflicts, the intervention, which is illegal by international law, it is then justified and exonerated by the UN Security Council passing a motion to send in peacekeeping troops, thus making the country permanently occupied. And certainly, this is a worrying extension of the UN's role, and certainly a worrying increase in UN intervention in Africa alongside other Western intervention. More news from Mali. The US is actually deploying troops in Mali now. They've deployed a small contingent of soldiers in Mali to assist the operations of the French and African troops. The Pentagon says around 10 US special operatives are in Mali, providing the international force there with operational support. The Obama administration had previously ruled out putting boots on the ground to aid the fight against the rebels in the north of Mali. Clearly, UN expansion in Africa is ongoing and increasing by the day. Over in Latin America, in Guatemala, the genocide trial of former US-backed Guatemalan dictator Efren Rios Montt has reopened under legal uncertainty. Rios Montt is accused of commanding the slaughter of more than 1,700 people in Guatemala's Tikal region after he seized power in 1982. Guatemala's top court annulled the case last week, sending it back to the earlier stages. The trial resumed on Tuesday, but Rios Montt's lawyers said the case had been thrown out and should continue. The testimony of four witnesses from the initial trial has also been thrown out. The case has been recessed until today. We'll be giving you an update next week. Clearly, what they're trying to avoid is testimony from that trial that would implicate the current government, members of the current government, about who are involved and complicit with the genocide of indigenous people that was attempted in the 1980s with the support, I would add, of the US regime, President Reagan at that time. In Palestine, there's been developments in that the Arab League appears to have changed their position on accepting land swaps for the settlements in the occupied territories. So the Arab League has softened their offer to Israel in recognition in return for the creation of a Palestinian state. The 2002 Arab Peace Initiative pledged normalized relations and full recognition of Israel if Israel completely withdraws from the occupied territories, based on the borders up to 1967, prior to the war in 1967. But at a meeting in Washington this week, the Arab League said it is now open to a deal that would see Israel retain a part of the West Bank under land swaps with the Palestinians. Israel has long dismissed the original Arab peace offer because it wants to keep the large illegal settlement blocks in the occupied West Bank. In Washington, John Kerry, Secretary of State, praised the change of heart from the Arab League, said the Arab community, and I think they should be thanked for this, saw fit to come to the US as a delegation of the Arab League to make it clear that they are relaunching the Arab Peace Initiative. All of them have agreed to that. Now, just got an announcement here. On Saturday, the 1st of June, at the US Embassy in London, there will be a demonstration, a day to defend Bradley Manning. Bradley Manning needs, no introduction, really. He is now the renowned whistleblower who has who released thousands of incriminating documents and evidence about human rights abuses in Iraq during the U.S. Occupation, and particularly the video film Collateral Damage of the helicopter footage as the helicopters attacked a number of defenseless people, including Reuters cameramen and journalists who were trying to film in Iraq. And then after killing all of those people, they then attacked people who'd stopped to give them aid to try to rescue the injured, and they blew up a van which had stopped, killing a number of individuals and wounding others, including young children, and particularly people will remember the attitude of the operatives there from the helicopter as they talk. They are remote and like they are dealing with, you know, some kind of a video game, as they blow these people up and remarking on the children who they've just blown up. They callously stated, well, they shouldn't bring their children into the battlefield. So that's you'll know about Bradley Manning for that. You know, he's you know, a brave young man who, you know, made the right decision to let the world know about these crimes, these war crimes. And this this was not actually the first thing that Bradley Manning had done. He had previously facilitated the connection between journalists and the people who could actually give information to them about human rights issues. While Jeremy Scahill was investigating the company, the mercenary company Blackwater, now known as Z, he was trying to find information about the Prince family and confirm the rumours that they were actually moving out of the country and moving to Doha. And Bradley Manning actually phoned Jeremy. This was prior to the WikiLeaks stuff, and said, look, I know somebody who's because of their job, they got information about the Prince family, and I'll put you in contact with them. So Bradley Manning is now in solitary confinement, which he has been for, now over 2 years. Even access to his lawyers is very, very difficult. So what we need to do is give some support to Bradley. If you can make it to London, if you live near there, you know, get down to the US Embassy at on Saturday the 1st of June. And if you want more information about this, it's www.wiseupaction.info. So last weekend I went down to the ground the drones demonstration at RAF Waddington in Lincolnshire, and this was a demonstration where we assembled in Lincoln and then marched about 3 miles out to the RAF base, RAF Waddington, and then assembled across from the base. There was very little activity there. The drones had clearly been grounded, and the only activity was generally military police on the base. It was a lively demonstration. There were about 800 people there. The demonstration was organised by the Stop the War campaign, CND campaign, the War on Want charities like that, and the Drones Action Group. So it was a lively demonstration. The theme was that every Afghan has a name. War is not a video game. And those were the slogans used on the day, and it really does sum up kind of dramatic escalation in death, remotely controlled death, remote controlled death coming out of the skies. Just to give you a flavour of, you know, what's happening in Yemen, the US Congress last week held congressional hearings about the drone war, which is being waged from the US. There are actually three different operations there. There's the CIA operations, and then the JSOC operations, Joint Special Operations Command, and now there is the also apparently the Foreign Council list for drone strikes. And of course now here in Britain we have our own drone fleet, which was previously controlled from the US Air Force Base Creech in Arizona in the United States, where RAF personnel have been controlling the British drones. Now, at the weekend, following our demonstration, the British government had to come out and admit that they're operating the drones from RAF Waddington in Lincolnshire. Now, at that congressional hearing, there was a witness, Faria al-Muslimi, who testified to the congressional hearing. And I'm now going to play you a short clip of Faria al-Muslimi's testimony. And just bear in mind that this is actually a young man who was very sympathetic to the U.S.
I am from Musab, a remote village mountain in Yemen. Just 6 days ago, my village was struck by an American drone in an attack that terrified the region's poor farmers. Musab is my village, but America has helped me grow up and become what I am today. I come from a family that lives off the fruit, vegetables, and livestock we raise in our farms. My father's income rarely exceeded $200. He learned to read late in his life, and my mother never did. My life, however, has been different. I am who I am today because the U.S. State Department supported my education. I spent a year living with an American family and attended an American high school. That was one of the best years of my life. I learned about American culture, managed the school basketball team, and participated in a trick or treat in Halloween. But the most exceptional experience was coming to know someone who ended up being like a father to me. He was a member of the U.S. Air Force. Most of my year was spent with him and his family. He came to the mosque with me, and I went to church with him, and he became my best friend in America. I went to the U.S. as an ambassador for Yemen, and I came back to Yemen as an ambassador of the U.S. I could never have imagined that the same hand that changed my life and took it from miserable to promising one would also drown my village. My understanding is that a man named Hamid al-Radami was the target of a drone strike. Many people in Wisab know al-Radami, and the Yemeni government could easily have found and arrested him. Al-Radami was a well-known to government officials and even to local government, and even local government could have captured him if the U.S. had told them to do so. In the past, what Wisab's villagers knew of the U.S. was based on my stories about my wonderful experiences here. The friendships and values I experienced and described to the villagers helped them understand the America that I know and that I love. Now, however, when they think of America, they think of the terror they feel from the drones that hover over their heads, ready to fire missiles at any time. What a violent militants had previously failed to achieve, one drone strike accomplished in an instant. There is now an intense anger against America in Musab. This is not an isolated instance. The drone strikes are the face of America to many Yemenis. I have spoken to many victims of U.S. drone strikes, like a mother in Ja'ar, who had to identify her innocent 18-year-old son's body through a video in a stranger's cell phone. Or the father in Shakra, who held his 4 and 6-year-old children as they died in his arms. Recently in Aden, I spoke with one of the tribal leaders present in 2009 at the place where the U.S. cruise missiles targeted the village of Al-Ma'jala in Lodar, Abyan. More than 40 civilians were killed, including 4 pregnant women. The tribal leader and others tried to rescue the victims, but the bodies were so decimated that it was impossible to differentiate between those of children, women, and their animals. Some of these innocent people were buried in the same grave as their animals. In my written testimony, I provide detail about the human cost of this and other drone strikes based on interviews I have conducted or have been part of. I have a personal experience of fear, of the fear they cause. Late last year, I was in Abyan with an American journalist colleague. Suddenly, I heard the buzz. The local people we were interviewing told us that based on their past experiences, the thing hovering above us was an American drone. My heart sank. I felt helpless. It was the first time that I had truly feared for my life or for an American friend's life in Yemen. I couldn't help but think that the drone operator just might be my American friend with whom I had the warmest and deepest relationship here. I was torn between this great country that I love and the drone above my head that could not differentiate between me and some AQAP militants. It was one of the most divisive and difficult feelings I have ever encountered. I felt that way when my village was also droned. Thank you for having this hearing. I believe in America, and I deeply believe that when Americans truly know about how much pain and suffering the U.S. airstrikes have caused, and how much they are harming efforts to win hearts, minds, and grounds in Yemen, and hearts and minds of the Yemeni people, they will reject this devastating targeted killing program.
That was Faria al-Muslimi giving his testimony to the U.S. Congressional hearings on drone strikes. Meanwhile, over in Geneva, there were some events at the non-proliferation talks. These are UN non-proliferation treaty talks in Geneva. And the Egyptian government representatives ceremoniously walked out of the talks to expose the sham of these nuclear non-proliferation talks that fail to deal with the issue of the Israeli nuclear capability. Israel is not signed up to the non-proliferation treaty, and therefore does not end up being the issue doesn't end up being dealt with. The US is clearly in denial and is carrying on a fiction whereby they're trying to put everyone else in denial, the rest of the world, of the Israeli nuclear capability. The diplomatic protest followed recent comments by the Egyptian officials pointing out the hypocrisy of Israel's secretive and undeclared nuclear weapons program. In a speech to the non-proliferation treaty, the Egyptian ambassador, Hisham El-Ada, said Egypt and many Arab countries have joined the non-proliferation treaty with the understanding that this would lead to a Middle East completely free of nuclear weapons. However, more than 30 years later, one country in the Middle East, namely Israel, remains outside the non-proliferation treaty. Reuters reported that US and Israeli officials stated that a nuclear arms-free zone in the Middle East could not be realized until Iran had curbed its nuclear energy program, that is, nuclear energy program. No mention of nuclear weapons, as Israel actually has. Meanwhile, as alluded to, Israel is the only country in the region that has a nuclear arsenal and the capability to deliver that to the neighboring countries. Despite this, Israel and the US refuse to discuss or even to acknowledge the Israeli nuclear weapons program. But they continue to threaten harass and cause hardship in the state of Iran. So there is no conclusive evidence that Iran is developing nuclear weapons. even has a desire to do that. They state that their nuclear program is for domestic energy production, and that they have no desire to possess such weapons. So that is actually quite a significant move on behalf of the Egyptians there, and it is noticeable that it has not been carried by the mainstream media. You will not hear that on the BBC. Here in Britain, the daughter of Shaka Amer, the last remaining British resident in Guantanamo Bay camp, and also one of the hunger strikers there, his daughter, Jahina Amer, has sent a letter to the British Prime Minister, David Cameron, imploring him to release her father, who has now been cleared for release from Guantanamo for several years, yet still remains in Guantanamo with no explanation for his continued detention. His return to the UK was demanded by the previous Labour government under Gordon Brown, and has now been called for by the current Conservative and Liberal Democrat coalition. William Hague has personally asked Obama to return Sheikh Amer, and they can provide no reason that he continues to be detained. Now, it is conjectured that Sheikh Amer is somebody who has, from the beginning in Guantanamo, been an organizer of the detainees. He is somebody who has taken the role of a negotiator for the prisoners, negotiating with the authorities in Guantanamo, with the US Navy, and also that he has been an organizer behind the hunger strike, and that for this reason they continue to punish him and to keep him in detention. So, over in in the EU, really, the EU, European Union, which is actually based at Brussels, have agreed to ease the oil embargo on Syria. Now, the oil embargo is an embargo on the government of Syria. So what they really mean is that they are now legitimizing the business of importing oil from areas that are under the control of the Syrian National Coalition, and under the effective control of Al-Qaeda like groups of Sunni jihadists. So we are effectively now doing business with these Syrian or Al-Qaeda like jihadi groups in Syria, which will be supporting them and escalating the conflict there. On Monday, the Council of the European Union agreed to ease the oil embargo on the opposition occupied areas of Syria so as to help the civilian population and the opposition. So again, this has had very little publicity and really should be, you know, given much more consideration by, you know, the public here. We need to be thinking about who and what, you know, we are supporting. And clearly one can see that this is, you know, also it shows what this is about. This is about keeping the oil flowing. You know, the intervention, occupation is all about keeping the oil flowing, changing the government, but keeping the oil flowing. So back in Guantanamo, the US Navy has called in more medical personnel. This was a part of their dealing with the rising numbers of hunger strikers there and their force feeding. So these hunger strikers are every day taken out of their cells and strapped to gurneys. Then they're taken to a medical center where the medical personnel there then force these tubes down their throats. And there's even complaints that they're using large tubes to make this more painful. This is in clear breach of the UN Human Rights Commission, which considers the practice of force feeding, in which the detainees are strapped to a restraining chair, the tubes pushed up their nostrils and liquid pumped down their throats as a clear form of torture. Now, one of the things I wanted to comment on this just this week, just before I go, because we're getting towards the end of the show, is the Boston bombings. And I've been reading a lot of reports on the Global Research website. That's www.globalresearch.ca, and the lots and lots of information about the lies that were being told, the constantly changing story, and this is really alerting people to, you know, the that something went on that wasn't quite what we're being told, because the story is changing by the day, and even the photographs, you know, contradict this. We see that there were two alleged bombers from of Dagestan origin in Russia. This is a Russian Muslim majority area in Russia, which is where they're fighting a war with the Russian government. And they were under surveillance by the FBI for 5 years while they visited these alleged training camps. So many things about what happened on the day. The older brother who was killed, Tamerlane, he was seen to be captured. He was captured intact. He was still alive when he was captured. And he had not been shot. So we see him alive, and then the next thing is he was killed in a firefight, and he had allegedly had a bomb even strapped to him. We see his body is full of horrific injuries. The younger brother, he's unarmed, and when they capture him, they shoot him straight through the throat, And now, you know, he can't talk. They're alleging that he confessed to everything in the hospital while they interrogated him, while he had this throat has been torn out and he's got 19 bullets in him. And he's confessed to everything, they're saying. So many different questions about this, about what they're alleged to have robbed a supermarket. Then it didn't happen. They're alleged to have hijacked a black SUV Mercedes. But from an unknown driver. And then it turns out they actually had a black SUV Mercedes registered to them. So I'm going to try and cover this in more detail next week, maybe, the Boston bombing, because definitely I think this is it's looking like a false flag operation, and lots of people are asking questions. Now, unfortunately, we're coming to the end of the show now, but please tune in next week to the Pax Mundi show, and you know, we'll have lots more news that you won't hear on the BBC or other mainstream media. And we'll be taking further, maybe discussion. We could have a discussion about the Boston bombing. That would be good. So, thanks for listening. Bye.